Thanks for listening to Here and Now. We want to know about your experience listening to this podcast, what you like and don't like. If you have suggestions or feedback, send us an email at hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's hereandnowpodcast@gmail.com.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the man who just can't seem to lose an election and could be a kingmaker in the 2016 race for the White House.
But first to the 2015 State of the Union address, which President Obama will deliver tonight. He plans to highlight income inequality and middle class issues, calling for higher taxes on the wealthy, making community college free for many students, and expanding paid leave for workers. But those proposals don't have much of a chance to win approval from a Congress now dominated by Republicans. Dan Pfeiffer is senior White House advisor. He joins us from Washington. And Dan, let's talk about what we've been hearing about the State of the Union and specifically this pitch that we've heard now from the president about some changes to the tax code. Why does he think this is going to be any more successful than the pitches he's been making for things like this throughout his presidency that have not gone over well with Republicans in Congress?
Well, I'd say a couple things. First, it's important to remember that, you know, a huge element of the president's economic plan in the first term was to ask the wealthy to pay a little more, to ask essentially the wealthiest 1% or so to go back to the levels that they paid under Bill Clinton. And we accomplished that at the end of 2012 in what was called the fiscal cliff deal. And so we've made progress on this. We've made more progress on this than anyone in recent memory. But what the president wants to do is lay out his vision for how the country should go, his vision for the direction the country should go, and encourage Republicans to do the same. The president's vision is based on middle-class economics, and let's have a debate. If we can find some things to agree on, we should do that. There are some elements of our plan that Republicans have supported in the past.
But we're also hearing from Republicans already that they would not support raising taxes on the wealthiest in order to pay for a middle-class tax cut.
I think they're going to have to go to the country and explain why they think the biggest financial institutions in this country shouldn't pay a little more, why we should keep one of the most egregious loopholes, the trust fund loophole, open, and why that's better than providing tax relief to the middle class. Let's have that debate and see where the country comes down.
Well, so is this about getting something concrete done, or is this simply about having Republicans make a case for the wealthy that clearly the president disagrees with?
Look, the president's got 2 years left. He's run his last campaign. All he cares about is getting stuff done. I think the best way to do that is for us to lay out our agenda. Let's have the Republicans lay out theirs, and let's see what in the middle, if we can find some things in the middle we can agree on.
I want to listen to a piece of tape here. This is from the ABC News analyst Matthew Dowd. This is what he said over the weekend.
The president's going to propose laws that he knows the Congress won't pass.
Right. But why won't they?
He knows that. He's doing it for political reasons.
I totally
and the Congress,
disagree.
On their side, is going to pass laws that they know the president won't sign.
Dan Pfeiffer, is that where we are now, that the president is going to propose things that the Congress isn't going to pass, the Congress is going to pass things that the president's not going to sign, and we end up getting nothing done?
I think we live in a time of divided government. So as Matt said, and Matt is, I think, is someone I have a great respect for, you know, Republicans have policies we're not going to support, we have policies they're not going to support. But if we can find some things in the middle that we agree on, we can get some stuff done. And the president's view, he said this publicly and privately, that if Republicans, you know, we're going to have big disagreements, but let's not let those disagreements prevent us from working on the things we agree on.
What about foreign policy? Is the president going to ask Congress to give him authorization for the fight against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, which many members of Congress, even on the Democratic side, have said he does not currently have the authorization to, for example, carry out airstrikes against ISIS in those countries?
Well, as the president has said before, he has the authority he needs to conduct the operations we're currently doing. But we would be better off as a country if Congress weighed in and was able to pass an authorization for the use of military force. And so he talked about that a lot this fall as the campaign against ISIL was ramping up. And you can expect to see the president address that in the speech tonight as well.
So he will ask Congress for more authorization?
He has asked, and you can expect that he will reiterate that ask.
And when you say that he has the authority now, is that based on the 2001 authorization of use of military force?
The 2001 authorization.
But which specifically says that it was for action against those who attacked us on 9/11.
And their affiliated forces. And lawyers have looked at this. The Department of the Office of Legal Counsel and Department of Justice looked at it. And there's pretty bipartisan agreement that we have that authority.
What will the president say tonight about the Paris attacks and combating extremism going forward?
He will address that tonight. I don't want to, like I said, I want to.
You don't want to give too much away.
You don't want to get ahead of the boss on a big speech, but that's obviously something that would be included in the part of the speech where he's addressing foreign policy.
Is this at this point about his legacy?
No, this is about what we can get done over the next 2 years, whether it's through Congress, through executive action, or by rallying the country as we have done on minimum wage, where Congress hasn't acted, but 17 states and District of Columbia have raised their wages since the president called for it at the State of the Union. So we're going to pull every lever we can to try to move the ball forward and put the country in a better position and help the middle class.
I want to ask you about one more thing. We have been interviewing a number of people about a number of issues on this program, and one of them is one of the president's former advisors, Larry Summers, who has made the case that the president should call for infrastructure projects, that interest rates are so low right now and that the country's infrastructure is in such dire need of upgrade that this is the time to call for that. Is that something that the president thinks he would like to do and could get done with this Congress?
Very much so. I don't know which specific infrastructure plan that Larry, who I worked with here in the White House, is promoting, but he will talk about infrastructure, and he has a belief that we should invest in infrastructure, and we pay for a lot of that by closing some of the tax loopholes that companies take advantage of. And so that'll be part of the speech, as he's been pushing for it for a long time.
Will you be in the chamber tonight, Dan, or do you have to watch this on TV?
I've done both. I've worked. This is my 6/7 State of the Union, if you count the very first speech during the address the president gives. And so I've done both. I'm going to watch it in front of the TV tonight with my phone in my hand, sort of in a two-screen experience like I think a lot of Americans will.
You'll be tweeting during it.
I will at least be reading tweets. We'll see if something moves me to tweet.
Dan Pfeiffer, Senior White House Advisor, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Be careful what you tweet. He's watching. Well, from the State of the Union to the State of the States, in particular Iowa, where the Republican governor, Terry Branstad, is on track to become the longest-serving governor in the country's history. Last week, he was sworn into his 6th non-consecutive term. Iowa Public Radio's Clay Masters reports on how Branstad keeps winning elections and why many of his fellow governors will be making appearances with him this year in this state that kicks off presidential elections.
Plain-spoken and mustachioed 68-year-old Terry Branstad has never lost an election in the swing state of Iowa. He was governor through much of the 1980s and 90s and came back to knock off an incumbent Democrat in 2010. Branstad easily won re-election in November, and his supporters celebrated at his latest inauguration.
Governor, repeat after me. I, Terry E. Branstad.
I, Terry E. Branstad.
After taking the oath of office, Branstad was quick to point out his long tenure as governor.
I still marvel at a system in a state where a poor North Iowa farm boy can be elected governor. It remains a great honor and privilege to have been chosen by the people of Iowa again and again to serve as your chief executive.
Branstad's speech focused on bipartisanship. The state has a split legislature, so he regularly has to work with Democrats. He also talked about strengthening the state's infrastructure and economy. There were more than 1,000 people in attendance. Iowa's Republican U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst were there. One guest stuck out, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. He's the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, and he's no stranger to Iowa. He made several stops here last year. He tells reporters he's just here to see his friend sworn in.
Branstad's taught me a thing or two about politics and how to govern. He's good at both, and nobody gets elected 6 times if they're not, so he's taught me a lot.
Terry Branstad has the magic touch. It is remarkable.
That's Dennis Goldford, a political science professor at Drake University.
He seems to campaign in terms of saying constantly to audiences everywhere, I love Iowa, I love this state. I don't think anybody doubts that. That itself is not a political program, but I think Iowans see him as one of them.
In 2012, the Iowa Republican Party was controlled by the Ron Paul Liberty Movement. Branstad is seen as a more mainstream Republican and led an effort to reassert control of the state GOP. Goldford says potential Republican presidential candidates will want to be seen with Branstad.
That doesn't mean that he's endorsing you. He's, again, his position is the more the merrier, and Iowa is important, and I appreciate your coming out here to affirm the importance of Iowa and start your campaign here.
Branstad's advice to any candidate is to spend a lot of time in Iowa.
Go to all 99 counties meet with the people, answer their questions, and that's, I think, how you can be successful. It certainly has worked well for me through all these years.
Meanwhile, back at the inauguration, Joni Skatter is posing for a picture with Governor Chris Christie. The 73-year-old is a longtime GOP volunteer who's sought after by many presidential Iowa campaigns. She hopes Christie runs and spends a lot of time in Iowa. She says there's plenty of room for all facets of the Republican Party here. She says Iowa Republicans will just need a candidate to run for president like Terry Branstad.
You want to know what? When we get a real good candidate like Branstad. Oh, did you see how many votes that man got? Woohoo! It was just phenomenal.
Iowa Republican activists will get a chance to meet plenty of potential candidates this weekend. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and many more are scheduled to attend an event sponsored by Iowa Congressman Steve King. Chris Christie says he'll be back here too, but don't read too much into that.
We're not voting in Iowa here for nearly another 13 months. So let's everybody take a deep breath, okay? I don't know about you, but I don't feel the need to rush something as serious as deciding whether you want to pursue the presidency of the United States.
And who will be one of the keynote speakers introducing all these guests next week? You guessed it, the unbeatable Terry Branstad. For Here and Now, I'm Clay Masters in Des Moines.
And while we're on the topic of Iowa politics, brace yourselves. Pollsters there are already gearing up for the 2016 presidential election. Gravis Marketing released a poll of registered Iowa Republicans last week that shows 2012 Republican nominee Mitt Romney is ahead of other potential GOP candidates who've floated the idea of running. He's the successful businessman who was, of course, seen as a little out of touch with the struggles of many Americans. But last week he told fellow Republicans at the RNC meeting that he plans to reintroduce himself as someone who wants to end poverty and income inequality. The polls show he has support from 21% of voters. That puts him ahead of Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, and Mike Huckabee. The Iowa caucuses are set for early 2016.
The 45th annual meeting of the World Economic Forum kicks off in Davos, Switzerland tomorrow. Thousands of delegates from more than 100 countries are descending on the ski resort to spend 4 days discussing money and politics. Tom Keene arrived in Switzerland yesterday. He's host of Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio and Television. He's with us from Davos. Welcome.
It's great to be with you. It's another exciting year here.
Well, tell us more about what this year is all about at Davos.
It's about going off the script. I looked at the panel selection, Jeremy, 3, 4, 5 weeks ago, and I was like, well, this is boring, and it's important issues. Don't get me wrong, diversity. They're finally beginning to talk about gay issues here, which is a big change. But as usual, about once every 5 years, all of it gets pushed aside. This is one of those years. I think it goes back to January of 2009. You've got all sorts of economic and financial issues, including that collapse in oil.
Well, you say that this is the most interesting year since 2009, and that, of course, the world was in the middle of an economic collapse. What is the economic picture this year?
There's a number of issues, but the broad one is identified by Christine Lagarde and the IMF as a new mediocre. This global slowdown with the IMF today putting out and marking down their GDP reports for many countries. That's the backdrop. But more than that is the financial side of economics, which is lower interest rates. How low can they go? And this idea, really an extension of that liquidity trap idea. We've been trapped for 7 years. Maybe the traps change, but it's still a great distortion of finance, none more than the Swiss National Bank a few days ago unpegging, and that's caused great shock within the system, and that's what people will be focused on.
And what you're talking about is that they unpegged the Swiss franc to the euro, and therefore the Swiss franc shot up in value, making it much more expensive for people to come into, people like you, by the way, to come into Switzerland with currency from outside. It shot up the cost by about 20%.
Well, it did. And, you know, I report, you decide. I'm pleased to report, Jeremy, that I had a number two value meal at the McDonald's next to our Zurich News Bureau, and it came in at $14.93.
Oh, wow.
For a cheeseburger, a small fries, and a Coke. Tasted great. not that I don't eat at McDonald's. The McDonald's at Route 24 at $4.95 is the one I love the best. Anyways, you know, there it is in Zurich, but you see the Swiss export economy. They are crushed by a stronger Swiss franc.
Okay, well, let's talk about an issue that does come up each year, has come up certainly in the last few years, especially because you've got all these very wealthy, powerful people coming into this very wealthy, powerful place at a time when we hear that there's this new report from Oxfam saying 1% of the world's population holds half of the world's wealth. How is the topic of income inequality being tackled this year at Davos?
It's an important question. I'm glad you asked it because there's nothing that I've heard in the Valley, and I've been coming 9, 10, 11 years, there's nothing I've heard more awkward. They bring it up, they give it lip service, but within the seminars, you'd be shocked, Jeremy, at the struggle as economic professionals, and frankly, many less professional, try to deal with it.
Are they trying to come up with solutions to it?
Well, Davos is not much about solutions. It's mostly about yammering. And I think the critics have a lot of constructive points about the hot air that comes out of the Swiss Valley. Within that, there's less solutions is identifying a set of solutions that government and policy leaders can pick from or choose from. Frankly, Davos is following the discussion of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other organizations. I would say they're a little bit behind on solutions, but actually, you know, it's the haves beginning to talk about it more.
We've heard as we've looked at various economic news around the world that the U.S., compared to the rest, it was described on this program as the prettiest dog in the kennel, that the U.S. economy is just doing better than most of the rest of the developed world, at least. Is that the sense at Davos?
Oh, yeah, no question about it. I was going to call this, Jeremy, Davos divergent over this word divergence, where the U.S. is separate and aside. And there's a raging debate on Bloomberg Surveillance about whether that's true or not. I've renamed my time at Davos here as Davos Unpegged in response to the Swiss National Bank move. But within that, there's still this debate less about bringing the mediocre up to speed of the U.S., but much more as the U.S. is the lead train, can it pull the rest of these economies forward? And I hear some real hesitation about that.
What about concerns about China? Are those playing heavily at Davos this year, China's economy slowing down?
Well, we saw China GDP today and the historical headlines get your attention. Some of the research notes I've seen, including Robert Cinch at Amherst Pierpont, are more optimistic and more constructive. The Chinese will come to Davos with a much greater delegation this year. And with that, I think they're on a learning curve about what to do not only with monetary policy, but what to do with their real economy. It's always interesting to see the geographic plays here between the Middle East, between Asia, and between the developed economies. Without question, though, the focus will be less on China and still much more on Europe. That's front and center because of that ECB meeting that we'll see Thursday.
ECB, you're talking about the European Central Bank. One more thing I want to ask you about, Tom Keene. You mentioned early on that people were talking about gay rights for the first time this year at Davos. What are they talking about?
I think it's a delicate issue. There are many, many issues at Davos, along with diversity and women's rights, that always get substantial visibility and lip service. And they're there and they're important. And some of those panels, not all, are fiercely attended. But I don't want to talk it up like you hear from the branding from the World Economic Forum, because mostly what Davos is about is a discussion of finance and economics and endless meetings for CEOs as they see their clients and customers. It's turned into one big network meeting that happens to have panels on gay rights, on diversity. They're front and center, but they're not as tangible Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday as a lot of people would like you to think.
So if it's all about deal making, what kind of deals are you expecting?
Well, it's not so much deals. You know, it's not like some of the retreats in the Rocky Mountains in the media world where you see tangible announcements come out. It's much more about a given CEO. Let's pick on Brian Moynihan at Bank of America. Brian Moynihan jets in, and I'm going to think he meets with 20 or 30 or 40 of his customers worldwide, meet and greet, how you doing? Maybe they talk about some deals. But it's just it is truly a constructive place for many CEOs to meet and greet within a multinational landscape.
Tom Keene, host of Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg TV and radio, joining us from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Tom Keene, thank you so much.
Wonderful to be with you.
And Tom Keene mentioned the cost of McDonald's in Switzerland. There is a Big Mac index that looks at the price of Big Macs around the world. And the latest index, which was before the surge in the Swiss franc, had Switzerland at number two, $6.83 for a Big Mac. Norway is number one at $7.76. The cheapest is Ukraine, $1.83. India is $1.75 for a Big Mac.
And since the rise of social media, Facebook, Twitter, even email, researchers have been on a mission to understand how the digital world affects us mentally. Now, you may say you don't need any research. You already know the answer is not in a good way. There's never any downtime. It's like the multiplying brooms in the movie Fantasia or kudzu, that weed that overtakes gardens in the South. And many studies have looked into what's being called informally social media depression. But a new study from the nonpartisan Pew Research Center says social media does not add extra stress to people's lives. The bad news it carries does. What's the difference? Kurt Wagner is social media editor for the tech news site Recode. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Well, and tell us more about what the study concludes.
Well, you kind of hit the nail on the head when you were just recapping it there. Essentially, what Pew found was that despite what we may have all thought about social media, the findings discovered that people who use social media are not necessarily more stressed out than those who aren't using social and other types of digital communication, for example, text messaging.
But what they are stressed out about, if I'm reading this correctly, is messages from their friends, let's say, if they are having trouble. So it's not the social media itself. It's the message that may be carried.
Right. So what Pew found is that it's not the medium, right? We've been getting bad news from our friends for years and years and years. It used to come via letter, then it came over the telephone. Now we're simply receiving that bad news. For example, a friend loses a job or someone is sick. We're receiving that information now over Twitter or Facebook or even LinkedIn. And so it's not the medium, it's not the platform itself that's stressing us out. It's in fact the news that we're learning via these social networks. That's what Pew says. He says that stress and the social networks themselves are actually mutually exclusive.
Well, I wonder if it's because it's multiplied. Maybe we get so many tweets, or we get them without any human connection, really. There's no voice. I wonder what the extra part is. But look, there's been other research. The Civic Science Company reported in the Huffington Post. They did research and quickly found that social network users are, in fact, 14% more likely than non-users to have somewhat stressful lives. Clearly, they write, there's a strong association between social media and stress. So this was in 2013, complete opposite conclusion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You work in social media. What do you think?
I found the Pew study to be really surprising, mostly because, to me, the act of reading things on social media, reading what others are sharing, is what it's all about. So I don't really see the difference between the platform and the content. I see those kind of as being the same thing, in my opinion, because you really can't have one without the other.
Well, you can't have Facebook without Facebook friends.
Exactly, exactly. So how are you going to enjoy that service but avoid all the bad stuff? It's pretty much impossible.
Yeah.
So I guess I was surprised. I associated the two.
Yeah. Well, you do say, or the Pew study does find, that there is one place where social media actually can relieve stress?
Yes. So there's a few instances that Pew found. Women in particular are actually reported less stress when they did a few different things. One is if they used Twitter. Two was if they emailed, I believe it was 25 plus times a day, so pretty heavy email use. And then the third one was if they're sharing photos via text message. So those three types of communication, for some reason, especially in women, lowered stress levels.
Or maybe if you just only use your social media to see what kittens can do. that would lower it too. Kurt Wagner,
exactly.
Social media editor for the tech news site Recode, on the Pew Research findings that social media doesn't add stress to your life. It's the bad news it can often carry. Kurt, thanks so much.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And he tweets at Kurt Wagner 8. We have an update now on a story we've been following for nearly a decade. You might remember the Massachusetts father, Paul Monty, whose son, Army Sergeant Jared Monty, was killed in Afghanistan in 2006. After Jared was buried in the National Cemetery on Cape Cod, his father noticed there were no flags on the graves for either Veterans Day or Memorial Day. The rules prohibited them. So Paul got that changed and started Operation Flags for Vets, during which volunteers flocked to the cemetery to place flags on the more than 50,000 graves on those two holidays. But you might say that was just the beginning of this story.
I think I have this right. Do you still drive Jared's truck?
Yes, I do. There it is. It's him. It's got his DNA all over it. I love driving it because it reminds me of him, though I don't need the truck to remind me of him. I think about him every hour of every day.
It's a Dodge 4x4, Ram 1500. It's got the decals, the 10th Mountain Division, 82nd Airborne Division, American flags, a bumper sticker for the Jared Monty Scholarship Fund.
My gold star plate on there. Go Army, you know, support the troops. And though it only gets pretty bad mileage, I'm happy driving it. He's with me. But he's with me all the time anyway.
That's Paul Monty speaking to Here Now's Alex Ashlock in 2011. Connie Harrington, a songwriter in Nashville, heard that conversation, and she was inspired to co-write this song, I Drive Your Truck.
89 cents in the ashtray, half-empty bottle of Gatorade rolling in the floorboard. That dirty Braves cap on the dash, dog tags hanging from the rear view. Old school kid.
Recorded by Lee Bryce, it won Song of the Year at the Country Music Awards in 2013. And now, the story that inspired that song has also inspired a book. Here Now's Alex Ashlock reports again.
Jared Monty grew up in Raynham, Massachusetts. He was part of a large Italian family. Michelle Monty is one of his more than three dozen cousins.
I grew up with Jared, you know, at Grandma and Grampy's house, having spaghetti, and always talk about his little round head and his little chubby body, and, you know, if he were here, I would embarrass him, and he would appreciate it. I don't think he'd mind.
On Sunday afternoon, Michelle Monty joined family and friends at American Legion Post 405. They came to meet Lynn Sandler, the author of the new book, See You on the High Ground, the Jared C. Monty story. Sandler sat next to Jared's father, Paul, as the two signed copies of the new book.
You're going to get reddish cramp. It's early and you've already got a big crowd here.
For Lynn Sandler, the book was a labor of love. He put aside the business he runs to write it.
Paul and I were friends when we were 9 years old. We met in elementary school. We went to junior high together and high school. Then we lost contact for 50 years, 50 years. And I knew about Jared. I followed the news, and I was busy doing my own thing, running my own business. And I kept saying to my wife, I should call Paul. Man, I should be there. I wasn't there for my friend.
So Lynn called up Paul, and Paul said he'd be happy to have his old friend tell his son's story. And part of the story includes this. Jared Monty died on a remote hillside in Afghanistan in 2006. He was doing his job, calling in air support and artillery to protect soldiers in the valley below. As Lynn Sandler says, Jared was on the high ground.
It's one of the military's most dangerous and most important jobs. And person after person told me that Jared was the best in the Army. He was the best that the Army had to offer at being a forward observer. He was the standard of what right looked like.
Jared Monty died trying to save a badly wounded fellow soldier, Private Brian Bradbury, who was trapped in the open after a Taliban attack.
The other soldiers knew that something had to be done and be done quickly in order to save Brian. Sergeant Cunningham, who was actually the head of the patrol but had his own squad, said, I'll go rescue Bradbury. Jared said, no, he's from my squad, I'll get him.
He tried three times to save Private Bradbury. He was killed on that third attempt. but his bravery that day earned him a Medal of Honor. At the award ceremony in 2009, President Obama said what Monty had done that day was not a moment of passing courage. It was the culmination of a life of character and commitment.
He was the kid at school who, upon seeing a student eating lunch alone, would walk over and befriend him. He was the teenager who cut down a spruce tree in his yard so a single mom in town would have a Christmas tree for her children. He even bought the ornaments and the presents.
As people had their books signed on Sunday, they reached out to shake Paul Monty's hand. He stood up to hug some of them. One of them was Warren Jones, an Army veteran who has helped to raise money for the Jared Monty Scholarship Fund.
He's a hero. He's a veteran. You can't forget our veterans. It's just something you can't do.
Not forgetting. That's what Paul Monty says this is all about. His son, Jared, died after he was hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. It's the kind of weapon that could be used to shoot down a helicopter. Instead, it killed a 30-year-old man who grew up in a small town in Massachusetts. Again, author Lynn Sandler.
Before he died, he recited the Lord's Prayer, and he said, "I've made peace with God. Tell my family I love them." And then he passed away.
After that happened, Paul Monty heard the knock on the door no parent wants to hear. But he's channeled his grief into advocacy for veterans. He started Operation Flags for Vets. He inspired the hit country song. Today, he says, he appreciates all the attention, but it's bittersweet.
No one could envision this for their child. Nobody, in any way possible. I don't care what kind of dreams you have. There's no way you could envision this kind of thing happening. All of that, of course, I'd give up to have my son back.
On Sunday afternoon, Paul Monty got back into Jared's truck and drove it home. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock. I drive your truck.
As has been the custom for years, when President Obama gives his annual State of the Union address tonight, about 24 guests will watch the speech from the First Lady's viewing box. This year, the president invited an Ohio veteran who lost both of his legs in Afghanistan, a 13-year-old from Chicago who wrote a letter to Santa Claus asking for safety, and Alan Gross, the former American prisoner in Cuba, whose release played a part in the thaw in relations between Washington and Havana. Republican House Speaker John Boehner countered by inviting the Cuban resistance leader Jorge Luis Garcia Perez. But also on the president's list, Dr. Pranav Shetty of Arlington, Virginia. As Global Emergency Health Coordinator for International Medical Corps, he established two Ebola treatment centers in Liberia. He joins us from the NPR studios in D.C. And Dr. Shetty, what an honor. What will you be thinking when you're sitting there?
Well, I mean, I think it's, as you mentioned, it's quite an honor to be invited to this prestigious event. I mean, I feel privileged to represent International Medical Corps and the tens of thousands of health workers that have been deployed to West Africa to deal with this humanitarian crisis.
Bring us up to date as to where we are in that crisis. We're hearing that it's abating in Liberia.
What we're looking at now is the stage where we can reflect on what has been accomplished and what we need to focus on moving forward. There's really a sense of cautious optimism in the field, baited by this idea that we can't be complacent right now in the fight. This is the time to get on top of this and get to zero cases as quickly as possible.
Well, what has been learned? We know President Obama sent 3,000 troops to build treatment centers at a huge cost. We're reading of one on imported gravel with chlorinated water, cameras that feed patient info to widescreen TVs. But there are no patients in many of these U.S.-built medical centers. Was this a case of not too little, but maybe too much too late?
Well, I think what we've learned as an international community is that you need to hit this type of outbreak hard and fast. And what we've seen is the results of that, a huge amount of investment, especially in Liberia, supported by the U.S. government. So I think really right now what the thing to focus is on is how do we get to zero cases? Because As you mentioned, there are a number of treatment centers, but access in these areas is very difficult. So they need to be geographically distributed. And this whole outbreak was started with one case and can start with one case again.
Well, and it may seem that because many of the U.S.-built medical treatment centers are empty, it was too late. But I'm reading in the Washington Post about a nurse in Liberia who was working in a place with just dirty plastic sheeting and mattresses, and she saw the American aircraft land and said she was jumping up and down and waving. She was so happy.
I think the initial input of resources and supplies and personnel that U.S. government brought, especially to Liberia, as you mentioned, really put a sense of hope and a sense that they're not, you know, we're not alone in this fight. For Liberian health workers that were on the ground dealing with this for many months before it even became an international public health crisis, to see that level of backing was a moral boost, along with the kind of the supply and physical boost and human resource boost that came along with it.
It's interesting. He chose you, and that's laudable. You, as you say, you represent all the people who risk their lives by going to Africa. Do you think he could have in his decision to, you know, because these are political decisions, who the president puts in his wife's box. Do you think he might have chosen somebody who reflected the U.S. story, a nurse from Maine who tried to educate people about how the disease spreads, or the family of a man in a city who died because he didn't get the proper care?
As you mentioned, you know, these type of decisions have political motivations behind them. But really, I think it's a testament to the effort put forth by the U.S. government in terms of pouring in so much resources, so many personnel, and so much attention into this crisis. And so I think embodying it with a U.S. health worker makes sense in that regard, and I hope to be able to live up to that expectation.
Dr. Pranav Shetty, Emergency Health Coordinator for the International Medicorps, who will be one of about 24 people on the President's guest list tonight during the State of the Union. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, if you find yourself looking for something more fun to watch after the State of the Union tonight, there's a new late-night show on Comedy Central. It's called The Nightly Show, and it's hosted by The Daily Show's former senior black correspondent, Larry Wilmore.
Yeah, we talk Selma Ferguson and Eric Garner. It's Comedy Central's worst nightmare. Brother finally gets a show on late-night TV.
The Nightly Show premiered last night in the 11:30 p.m. time slot that used to be occupied by the Colbert Report, and NPR TV critic Eric Deggans stayed up late to catch it. Eric, welcome back.
Glad to be here. And by the way, I did DVR it. I could not stay up late to watch it.
Okay. So. All right. Well, what did you think?
You know, I thought it was a really good start. As I said in a piece I did about Larry's show for Morning Edition, a late-night show has two parts. It has the format or the structure of the show, and then it's also how the host inhabits that format, how they change it to fit their comedic sensibilities and their talents. So what we saw on Monday night was a very strong and basic structure, where he comes out and cracks some jokes about the day's news, gets the show started, and then brings on a panel where they kick around different topics. It's something that if you've seen Bill Maher's HBO show Real Time.
Yeah.
It's very similar to that structure, and it also satirizes a little bit these panel shows like Meet the Press and This Week.
Well, let's take a listen to a little more from last night's show. This is Larry Wilmore talking about the Oscars and the nominations of all white performers in the acting categories this year, giving the snub to some notable black actors.
You know, I wish there were a black Hollywood expert who could go to bat for us.
Reverend Sharpton has called for an emergency meeting here in Hollywood next week to discuss possible action around the Academy Awards.
Sharpton? Again? I mean, no one else can represent us. Look, Al, slow down, man. You don't have to respond to every black emergency. You're not Black Batman.
Eric, what is going to set this show apart? And is it going to be primarily a show that makes jokes about race?
Well, as you heard from the clip, Larry is very deft at crafting jokes about race that people who aren't black can relate to. So I think that's something they're going to talk about a lot. And that's indeed the purpose of the show. show. And one of the things that struck me, for example, is there were four guests on the show and Larry and only one white person, which you never see in late night television because Larry is the only black person to host a late night entertainment talk show. So no one else will be able to talk about race the way he does. And no one else certainly can make the jokes from the perspective that he can. And so I'm sure this is something they're going to talk about a lot, but they also made it plain that they're going to talk about things besides race. And he's very well equipped to do that, too.
Well, tell us more about him. Besides being the senior black correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, he's been a TV writer for decades.
Yeah, he's been a TV writer and producer. So he started as a writer on shows like In Living Color. Then he co-created the animated series The PJs with Eddie Murphy, if you remember that, on Fox. And then he also was the showrunner and executive producer of The Bernie Mac Show, which was also on Fox. And most recently, he was an executive producer on the ABC comedy Black-ish. And so he has been looking for an outlet for this kind of humor for a long time. And he's 53 years old. He thought the opportunity had passed him by.
And is the expectation that he is going to hold the Colbert Report audience, or is it going to be a different audience altogether?
Well, certainly I think that's the goal, is to hold the Colbert audience. And what we see with these shows is there's always a big bump when they first debut because there's been a lot of publicity. People are wondering what the show's going to be like. And then it'll drop off. And then as he starts to inhabit that format more, the true fans of the show will emerge. And if he's lucky, they'll get an audience that's comparable to what Colbert had. That's something that we'll see as time passes. But like I said, I think it was a particularly strong start. The format is solid. Now all they have to do is figure out ways to really distinguish what they're doing. And, you know, they say they're going to talk about Bill Cosby in the next show this evening. And certainly that's a way to distinguish yourself.
Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic, talking to us about the nightly show with Larry Wilmore, which debuted last night on Comedy Central. Eric, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.